Welcome to the Better Call Saul edition of the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the Neelix to my Felix, it's Dan.
Wow, there goes the first thing I was going to say.
The rare time I beat you to an annoying Star Trek reference, but I thought it was...
Literally.
And I thought it was perfect because one can make the Star Trek reference based on an actor who appeared in this week's episode of Better Call Saul, and Felix because Neil Simon passed away recently, you know, the creator of Felix and Oscar, so...
And I recently watched that movie with Jack Lemmon.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Mathel,
it's even in your head. We should also mention, or do you prefer doing the intro? Would you like to introduce our resident legal counsel here?
Yes. Tonight, from the great state of Kentucky, where he maybe is right now. I guess I wasn't paying attention to what state park he was in. But the amazing, incredible... sometimes replacement, maybe permanent replacement. Brian, welcome to the show, Brian. And cicadas.
Hey, guys. I don't know if you can hear because I'm starting a
connection problem.
Oh, your timing is impeccable.
Yeah, it's immediately we spool up. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you fine.
Okay, it's sort of going in and out. If it dies, I'll just crash off. But hey, how you doing? Glad to be here. Sorry, if you hear noises, it's the cicadas in the night.
Oh yeah, you know, you are the king of outdoor background noises for this podcast. So,
Fair enough.
Yeah, so we have gotten Brian back on board, and we're going to be talking about the latest episode, of course, of Better Call Saul. That's why we're here. Oh, I did want to mention a little stupid minor anecdote. So just a little while ago, just earlier this evening, I was putting together a very, very brief, rough outline, kind of bullet point kind of a thing for tonight's podcast, right? At the same time, a friend of mine, you know, someone, love her dearly. I think I made a reference to her in a previous podcast that she had started watching Better Call Saul without having seen Breaking Bad. Well, apparently, as of this week, she decided to switch gears and start watching Breaking Bad. So as of this evening, and I was getting multiple texts from her about it, she was just finishing up season 2 of Breaking Bad. So I'm talking to her by text, you know, about that. You know, I'm telling her the thing about looking for the titles of the episodes that had the little black and white segments and see what it actually spells out or reads out, however you phrase it, so on and so forth, whatever. And then I realize that I'm doing that while I'm trying to type the notes, I'm going back and forth between that and typing up the notes for tonight's podcast, and I noticed that every time I was supposed to type Better Call Saul, I was typing Breaking Bad. I just looked and I was like, wait a minute. Why is Breaking Bad like here like 6 times? Like, oh, I mean, it doesn't matter. I'll know what I'm talking. But just so you know, if at a certain point I accidentally say Breaking Bad, it's probably because it's just in my head right now. But luckily, it's just like really just bullet point kind of thing. So it's not like there's a script I'm following here or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we definitely. I'll try to correct you if you say it because, you know, with plenty of nacho in this episode, it'd be easy to confuse Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. For Brian, anyway.
Oh boy.
Thanks, Dan. Of course, it would be.
Yeah. Well, the main reason we bring on anyone onto the podcast is so we can occasionally mock them. So.
Hey. Considering I'm known for killing things, you should be okay with me, like, not letting something die for once.
Well, you can't kill your lawyer.
Yeah.
Not yet, at least.
No.
Anyway, with that little bit of business out of the way, let's get into the latest episode of Better Call Saul. Now, the latest episode, which is the fourth episode of the season, was titled Talk. It was directed by John Chabon. Turns out he directed Breaking Bad Sunset, as well as a few Better Call Saul episodes before. And it was written by Heather Marion, who has also written a couple earlier Better Call Saul episodes. She's even story-edited a few. And in a short time, she's gotten around. She's done some acting. She's been assistant to showrunners. She's done a whole lot of stuff just over the past several years, so... So there you go. Now, one time I remembered to look that stuff up. It's not really all that interesting to any of us, but who cares?
Well, you know, Chabon was one of the X-Files dudes, so that's always cool. Plus, plus I think he was showrunner or something on Hell on Wheels for at least a season or two, which is, you know, kind of cool.
And he also, that show. Right. He also directed a couple episodes of Hell on Wheels as well.
Yeah.
So with this episode, it's interesting because even though you've got an episode with a rather violent firefight in the middle of it, in a way, the alternative title for this episode, like if it was like an episode of Friends or something, would be the one where not very much happens, at least in terms of plot and pacing. But it does start to move the pieces around the board a bit. I personally think it's still kind of fuzzy what the main character, i.e. Jimmy's plot trajectory, is going to be for the season. So, but based on the rather static nature of the episode, I think it makes it even easier just to hack this one up into quarters, so we can focus on, you know, the four central characters of the episode here. So let's start with, you know, the main character, who is Jimmy. Just to give I can start to just run down what happens with Jimmy, but we can certainly break into this at any point just to talk about, you know, those specific moments. You know, for example, the first Jimmy thing that happens is, you know, he gets a call from a cell phone store to be, I think, you know, the sales manager at a specific location, and he turns down the job. So he's continuing what we had seen in a previous episode of Jimmy's good enough to, you know, either it be resumes or interviews or whatever, to nail down whatever job he seems to be going for, but he keeps turning them down because they're just not, I guess they're just not exciting him. It's not appealing to the slipping Jimmy nature of him, or the soon-to-be Saul Goodman nature of him. However we want to read that. But then, the thing I thought was interesting when Kim speaks to him. And remember, the last time we saw Jimmy and Kim, she had left the room because she was upset about the letter, and one would think she might have also been a touch upset about the way Jimmy was acting, reacting, or not really reacting to the letter as well. Because one of the first things she brings up to him is the idea that he should speak to someone, you know, someone like a therapist or a shrink, as he says. So, of course, he lies to her about the job just in order to deflect the whole therapy conversation. And he ends up calling them back and taking that job. So I'll admit, when he first did that, the first note I wrote when I was watching the episode, was like, that's a really big lie. What is he thinking? And then, you know, right away he ended up calling them back to get the job. Did anyone have that momentary thought as well? Huh. At that moment, like, that's a big lie there. You know, what are you doing there?
Yeah, that's a pretty big risk. Do you guys think that, part of what he's doing here is kind of like he wants like as many businesses as possible to, I'm not drunk, I'm just slurring my speech for no reason. He wants all these businesses to accept him, like, you know, because Chuck like kind of thoroughly rejected him right before he like kicked the bucket. So maybe he just like wants to feel needed by like somebody, even though it's like, you know, just on like a temporary basis. So applying for like a zillion jobs that like call and like, or like actually want him. Maybe kind of like feeding that kind of screwed up Chuck crap a little bit.
Hmm. Oh, that's interesting. I haven't really thought about it that way.
Right.
I think that it's the idea that Jimmy doesn't want anything sort of mundane, but when Kim sort of asks what's going on, and he tells her everything's great. He feels the responsibility to take a job, have something to do, because she's going off to work and has gotten up, made coffee, and I think he just feels the need to do something, and at that point decides, what the heck, I'll call back and take the job to have something.
And an excuse to avoid therapy, too, because he definitely wasn't feeling that.
Yeah, I love the idea of just imagining a scene of Jimmy in therapy. I think that would be fascinating. Whatever version of Jimmy McGill it would be, I just think it would be fascinating. Because I suspect he could be the type of person who would be the kind who'd say what he thinks the therapist wants to hear, or basically run a con on the therapist just to find his way, quickly find his way out of it, rather than go anywhere near his actual feelings. I kind of think, at least for the bulk of this season, whatever feelings he has have been boxed up and put away for either forever or until they end up, you know, exploding at some point later on this season, which I guess could conceivably happen, because he's really suppressed and compartmentalized all the stuff with Chuck and so on. So then we go from there, and he does take that job at the mobile phone store, and it's basically boredom city for him there. And we see him making like the Cooler King from The Great Escape, where he's taking one of these little balls that they have in the store, and he's throwing it repeatedly against the windows. Funny thing is, when I was first watching the scene and him looking at all the merchandise, I was thinking, oh, it's making me think of Saul Goodman's drawer with all the cell phones in it. And then I realized, oh yeah, didn't they use that image in the opening title credit this week with all the cell phones? So that they kind of foreshadowed it a little bit in their own opening titles, which is something they don't normally do, I don't think, on the show, but they certainly did this week.
Yeah, unfortunately, one of our friends spoiled me on that, so it kind of ruined the episode for me. But you know, it was okay.
Is that a shout out to Jamie? Is that what you're doing, Dan?
Yeah, more of a curse, a veiled curse, maybe an undertone of threat and menace. Yeah.
So he does eventually leave the store to go meet up with Ira, basically to get his cut from whatever the haul was for that Bavarian boy, Hummel. Turns out to be a much bigger cut than they had expected. When he leaves, Ira does tell him the next time they want to do a job together, just call that vet, who is kind of like the go-between for all the minor and medium-level crooked operations in that part of the country. And I think, essentially, for whatever reason, that leads to we see Jimmy painting across the windows of the store. And as the camera pulls back, we see what he's painted is the letters spelling out, "Is the man listening? Privacy sold here." Which kind of looks like he's trying to appeal to a certain baser element to get people to come buy cell phones. I'm thinking maybe he's going to be selling burners more than anything else, because it seems like you're trying to appeal to either a paranoid or more likely a criminal element. Is that how you guys took that as well? Brian?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I took that to be like the store didn't have much business. He was bored, and he thought, here's a way to maybe drum up business. Mm-hmm. And it's a perfect intersection of where he's headed and where he's been, that, you know, maybe that's how he ends up with all those drawers. With all those cell phones in the drawer later in Breaking Bad.
Right. I mean, you could even extrapolate it to, if that's basically making it appeal to a certain clientele, the type that are more likely to want, cell burners and stuff like that. The type that don't want, their conversations to be listened in on, certainly. Maybe this is also the going beyond, the vet, and a few other people that he's met in the first few seasons of Better Call Saul. This is, I almost said Breaking Bad. it's been in my head tonight. I'm sorry. I'm trying not to. Perhaps this is all one could say, hey, this might be another way that he starts to make those connections, which obviously we know, you know, several years later will have come to major fruition.
And I kind of see it like he's developing like his business model, because as Saul Goodman lawyer, he definitely was appealing to like the same kind of people he presumably is trying to come get burner phones from him. So I'm guessing that this is probably going to go over like, hotcakes, actually hot waffles for him. And, that'll, you know, stick with him. And then when he becomes a lawyer, he will definitely continue to do business with these slightly extra legal people.
Yeah, I'm wondering if there'll be a future scene, maybe in the next episode or two, depending how long he's there for, where the people who own these stores, you know, they notice like the huge uptick in business or something, or they come down there and they see what's painted across the windows, and you know, there might be some sort of ethical dilemma of like, and they see the element that's there buying the cell phones and kind of wondering, I'm not so sure about this. Or is it basically going to be money talks and finally the place is making money and maybe they'll approve of it? Again, that might not happen at all, but I'm kind of wondering how that goes.
In a way, the big window painting, I mean, that's sort of like his first foray this season we've seen into self-promotion, and we've seen in the past, you know, his splashy TV ads and the things he does. I mean, that's the only way. Obviously, the cell phone store isn't going to give him a budget to do a big TV ad yet, no. But that would be kind of interesting to see him do a TV ad for the cell phone company later in the season.
And maybe he could do a reprise of the character that he did in those ads before, who was basically Saul Goodman, you know, to at least to a certain extent, it was, you know, only with some facial hair, if I remember.
Well, we haven't seen the film school dudes and women this season yet, so it'd be nice to see some kind of a schlocky cell phone ad happening.
Right. I think I'd like to shift over to Kim now. Kim really, she essentially really only appears in Act 2 of this episode, so she's like, you know, it's one act and done for Kim. But I think it's a pretty significant scene for her. Basically, she goes down to the courthouse just to be there to observe, you know, all the little penny ante trials that are going on. Or actually, Brian, you probably have a better sense and probably can think of the correct terminologies, because I know I'm forgetting how to phrase it right now. Now, what's happening here is are these all just like pre-trial motions that are happening at this stage when they're just the initial presenting of the cases?
It looked like what we call like a normal docket. Where a judge just calls everything that's not scheduled for trial, which can be like an arraignment, a pre-trial conference, or a hearing. And it looks like she's just sort of going and watching to see what's going on in that courtroom. And I had some thoughts. I don't know if it's just her looking for a different area of law because she's kind of getting the heebie-jeebies about Mesa Verde. Mm-hmm. Or if she's just going to sort of see something and, you know, like that's what Jimmy did. Mm-hmm. So going and seeing that gives her a greater understanding of Jimmy. What she did was just sort of go see what you would see most times if you followed me or one of the lawyers I supervised to court, a regular docket call.
Right.
Judge Neelix definitely seemed to think that she was just there trying to, like, you know, find some other legal path, just kind of like, you know, fall on her lap. So at least, you know, maybe that's not exactly what she's doing, but he definitely seemed to get that opinion of her.
But I should probably mention it. So the judge, whose name is Mungsinger, played by the actor Ethan Phillips, who's a guy who's an character actor who's been around for a good 40-odd years. I mean, I remember the guy on Benson, quite frankly. But many people, especially the geekier people out there, will remember he played a not too, as far as I know, not the most beloved long-running Star Trek character in the Star Trek universe. Was it on, was it Voyager?
Yes.
Yeah, so he was the alien Neelix on Voyager. Right. And getting back to what Brian was saying and about trying to determine why Kim was there, it seems to me it's just, not just, but there's kind of a parallel right now with Kim and Jimmy, because she could very easily just carry on working for Mesa Verde, you know, obviously make a lot of money, whatever, but there's something about it, about, you know, this corporation, and you've got all these bank opening up all these banks and branches, and the idea that, like, this is going to be her life from this point on. Maybe that's really not what she got into the law for, or maybe based on her experiences, and, you know, quite honestly, almost she could have died in that car accident. Maybe she wants something that is more fulfilling, or just has a more of a spark to it. I think her motivation might be somewhat more noble than, say, what Jimmy's is, but I do think there is a certain commonality between them right now, as far as that's concerned.
I was gonna add, and the judge's statement to her in chambers sort of reflects the more cynical Jimmy view of the law.
Yes,
that you have a good gig. Why mess it up? Make all the money you can. You've got a client that can pay you lots of cash. Why do you not want to stick with that? So it was kind of interesting. And I will say, having dealt with and dealing with a lot of judges, that his portrayal of being, there are the sort of been on the bench a long time, burned out, cynical judges, just like there are cynical lawyers. Mm-hmm. I thought the actor did a really good job. I don't know that, you know, most judges would quote The Verdict, you know, use the movie The Verdict as the template to sort of test a lawyer, or, you know, use that as a morality lesson. But I thought his portrayal of a judge wasn't too far off.
Well,
thanks.
For me personally, that moment when he says, oh, you know, I've actually heard about a case that you might be right for. And then he goes on to basically describe the entire plot, at least the law, the legal case at the center of The Verdict. I realized what it was a little ways into it. Not initially, but afterwards, I was like, wait a minute, this sounds like, and then when they said it, I was like, that might be my favorite moment. Well, no, wait, I forgot, no. That might be my third favorite moment in the episode, because I also happen to love the movie The Verdict. So
it's a great moment, and the way that he's kind of an asshole about it, but not a total asshole about it. You know, I think that's, I'll probably get in trouble saying this, but, you know, there's something about wearing a black robe that after a period of time and years and years and years, to some people, it does go to their head and they think they have certain wisdom to dispense. And some of them do and some of them don't. But, you know, I got the sense that he probably was a knowledgeable judge who really thought he was telling her something. But it just came at an unfortunate time when I don't know that it's necessarily what she wanted to hear.
Well, that's probably true. I mean, that's probably true, but at the same time, it's hard to deny the truth of what he said, although it will be funny if she does end up with a case that's really something that really sparks her interest and gets her juices flowing and so on. I mean, it might not be, as he phrases it, one of those once-in-a-lifetime cases you only see in the movies, but I'm sure it'll be something better than the one thing we saw her witness in court that day. Watch, that's the guy she ends up representing. Because he does warn her, and the important thing about the scene is that he warns her that, you know, what I think he uses the phrase, you know, right now they're dealing with perpetual, you know, PD overload, public defender overload. So if he sees her in his court, he's going to end up putting her to work. So then when he returns after recess and gets back up on the bench, There she is. So she's there expecting and maybe even kind of almost daring or hoping that she'll get put onto some sort of case, just something to really, that'll get her going again. Because obviously working in banking is not going to do it for her anymore.
Well, the PD overload is real. Most people, I mean, I'm a public defender or supervisor, and caseloads are always an issue, always a problem. Mm-hmm. There are different systems in our state. Like, all public defender cases go to us unless there's a conflict of interest where we have to contract with outside counsel. As we saw earlier seasons of Better Call Saul, it was, they have a contract system where lawyers like Jimmy and other people take contracts for those cases, which a judge can appoint local bar. Now, I don't know in their system if you can involuntarily appoint a lawyer, but in some systems in the past that has occurred, that, you know, if you were in the court and there wasn't a lawyer, somebody got appointed a lawyer. So, mm-hmm. you know, that's very realistic. It's a caseloads are an issue with public defender systems everywhere. And I'm sure at that time there, it was no different.
Right. It reminded me a little bit of something they did in one season of the show, The Good Wife, which was, you know, a lot of it was about, you know, a legal drama where the main character ended up being put into the mix, where all the different public defenders are all there, just, you know, waiting, you know, and being assigned various cases, and they all have mountains of work, and how they have to quickly process through them. It's, you know, it's kind of like an, you know, it's like a meat churning assembly line kind of a situation, which was done to dramatize, you know, exactly what you're talking about, the overload that these people have, the sheer amount of cases they have to go through, and how some clients won't necessarily get maybe the best representation possible as a result of that. Especially, I'm sure that's across the board, you know, across the country, I mean, but like The Good Wife takes place in Chicago, you know, so a place like that, I'm sure it's even more extreme, or New York or LA or things like that. But I'm sure it's even in smaller places as well, because people are committing crimes everywhere, so as you know, Brian.
Well, the interesting thing about that conversation tonight, a lawyer and I were talking at dinner, and their court system wants them from arraignment to trial to process a case in 90 days. And cases that were arraigned this week were set for trial in November. Now, to the normal person, that may sound like a lot of time, but if you have 100 current open cases, how do you manage your time to give that person, you know, effective representation? And it's a challenge we're always dealing with. And, you know, I thought that was whoever wrote the legal part, you know, did their homework, and I thought did a good job.
Cool. And a weird coincidence, I got my jury summons today too. So
Remember, Scott, there is a word besides guilty. You can also add the word not in front of it.
Nah. Everyone's guilty. I try to do a segue saying speaking of guilty, but it doesn't really apply to this guy. But let's swing over to Nacho, who I don't think he appears himself until Act 4. Three, if I'm not mistaken. I might be wrong about that. I can't remember if we see him briefly earlier on. No, he's not in that scene. So it's Act 3. So Nacho, he's with those cousins, and they spot that silver sports car that he had mentioned in the previous episode. So this is basically where, you know, the Espinozas are, who I guess are another major little drug family gang, whatever you want to call them, like not quite a cartel, but we know what I'm talking about here. Now, despite Nacho's assertion that the whole place, you know, it's like a fortress, and so they want to get more people so they can storm it at a later time, I love that the cousins, they just gather up the little bag of guns and they just calmly go out and massacre almost everyone. You know, except for maybe there's that one guy, that Nacho, who is still, he's not just wounded, still wounded. He clearly still needs, real medical attention. There's blood seeping out of his wounds, and his skin tone isn't looking good, whatever. So eventually, they pretty much wipe out everybody. And later we see him reporting back to Fring that's what happened. And apparently the cousins went back to Mexico to kind of lay low for the time being. And then Nacho kind of mans up a little bit while he's talking to Gus. Because he tells him that he realizes that this is all about territory. And really not realizing that, kind of like the Salamancas just did his work for him. And now he can move in on that territory. And the final exchange between Fring and Nacho does have less of an edge than their previous, now you're mine kind of way he spoke to him before. Maybe it seemed that Gus kind of almost appreciated that the spark of intelligence that Nacho was exhibiting here, the fact that he actually had the nerve to say that. Without getting too far, without getting out of line at the same time. So, what'd you guys think of that? What'd you think of all that stuff, Dan?
I don't know.
Had your chicken man in it, so yeah.
Yeah. I was mostly impressed with how Michael Mando was acting in this episode. I mean, not that he's ever done crappy work, but he's really, just him and Howard and everybody. We've been able to see some of these other side characters have the chance to kind of step it up a little bit this season. I mean, just doing different stuff, and I enjoy seeing that actors, performers, whoever that we like, having the ability to show off what they can do. So I just thought it was it definitely was a intense, interesting scene, but it definitely was all about Nacho and the facial expressions that he was pulling off there are so much going on there, just really solid stuff. Not something I would expected from some dude that I just knew was like a schlub on Orphan Black that didn't quite have to pull off a lot of range. So
it's
nice, especially after the first season, when he kind of his character kind of got sidetracked a little bit. It's nice that he actually has the ability, or he can just do some stuff now. I keep saying ability for no fucking reason, so screw that.
Yeah, I was like, wait, that's even worse than interesting, because at least ability is not the right word. It was also kind of fun that a lot of what we were seeing were basically watching him watching what was happening. And, I think his initial reaction is like, Salamancas, because this is what they do. They just go in guns blazing, just mow down everybody. And I was trying to figure out in the moment when he finally does decide to get out of the car and kind of find his way to maybe join the fray, which is very limited because he ends up, pretty much almost collapsing because of his wounds, even though, like I said, he does shoot one guy. I was trying to figure out, is he doing that because he just trying to, maintain his covers, showing that he would be involved in this? Is he doing it because he actually does have a genuine sense of obligation or even any level of concern because doesn't, at this point at least, he doesn't necessarily want the cousins to get killed. I guess there's a couple ways one could look at it, and maybe all are true to whatever extent.
I think that it's a combination of fear, knowing the situation he's in, and the whole scene and a lot of stuff. It really made me reflect on, there's something about when a show does a lot of exposition that you feel like it's dumbing it down. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because we know where the story's going, that when we see exposition and they show a character react to it, you get to watch that character and see them figure it out when you already know what's happening. Mm-hmm. And I like that. I like that you see Nacho sort of coming to the realization that, these two guys are ultimate badasses. I'm working for a guy who's really smart. And it's a little troubling when he shows some intelligence, the fact that we don't see him in Breaking Bad. If you're too smart and you know too much and you rise too quick, you know, that often doesn't end well. But I like watching him observe it, see it, and see him come to a realization of what we already know, and see that his mind is working ahead and figuring it all out.
Well, maybe Vince Gilligan can kind of pull a horrible George Lucas kind of thing, and he can like redo, you know, the first couple seasons of Breaking Bad, and like just like CGI Nacho into scenes with Taco.
Kind of, yeah. He can be Nacho the Hutt, and figure out a way to include him in things, or later, or even better, you know, they can go back and do Breaking Bad and just put him in the background somewhere. You know, on the 10th anniversary DVD Blu-ray.
Right. Add an extra or something like that.
This scene had me wondering if, like, there's also an element of Nacho just kind of realizing the situation that he's in and just kind of, like, you know, like, getting to the point where, like, yeah, if somebody takes him out during this kind of, like, the shitstorm that got set up by the orders that Fring, gave him, you know, I just wonder if he's just kind of like, you know, in a way he just kind of wouldn't mind just somebody just, you know, just dying and this kind of thing and being done with it, because he thought, you know, as he tried to get out and he just got so much farther in.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, because the thing is that we know from the way these characters are is if Nacho double crosses or does something and doesn't succeed, they know his dad real well.
Yeah.
And it has consequences just beyond him and his ambition, because the tie to his father, if he makes a move and fails, it's catastrophic beyond himself.
Right.
Yeah, but if, go on. And if he does get taken out, like trying to back up the Salamanca brothers, maybe his dad would be, they'd leave him alone then, because they'd just be like, oh yeah, I don't know, I'm not going to do a really shitty Mexican accent here, but yeah. I'm not.
please don't, Dan. Please don't do that.
I'll save the racism until I try to run for Congress or something in Wisconsin.
There you go.
Or move to Florida. Apparently it works there.
Or podcast with Jason again. Anyway. There's a callback. Oriental. Anyway. Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, in the Nacho wrap-up, I did leave out, speaking of his father, that at the end, later that evening, his father returns home. Or actually, is it his home, which is part of the auto shop? Are they connected? It seemed, I wasn't clear on that.
Yeah, I think it's his father's, like, home is, like, you know, the business is the same. You know, he has a residence at the business itself.
Okay,
so,
okay.
Upholstery thing.
So, when his father first gets home, and he's already aware that someone's there, and he pretty much knows it must be his son, and before he sees him, he's pretty much, you can tell that they, based on what had happened with Don Hector and everything else, there had still been a falling out between them, because he's telling him, you know, I don't want you here, leave, whatever, until he actually comes into the room and sees that his son looks like he's practically dying. Although he's told not to call the hospital, that he'll be okay, he just needs a place to stay and heal and so on and so forth. So it kind of ends the Nacho storyline in this episode on kind of a, you know, poignant, sad little moment there between father and son. I also, by the way, and I might have mentioned this on an earlier podcast, maybe from last season, I don't remember. I also got a kick out of the fact, because the actor who plays, and I did not look up his name, so I'm not going to be able to name check him right now, but the actor who plays his father, I remember just from a couple years ago, he was a very corrupt Mexican police captain or chief of police or whatever in the show The Bridge. That was on FX. It was a very good show that, unfortunately, probably very few people ever got a chance to see. I wish they had gotten a couple more seasons out of it because it was really high quality. But I just, it's like the only two things I've seen him, this character, this actor play, and I'm sure he's probably done, you know, 50 other things, are complete opposites. They're just total opposite characters. You know, one is a detestable thing, you know, who has no honor. And then you have this person who's all about honor, who's all about, you know, being honest. Whereas the other person, where the character I'd seen him play before, was anything but. So I just, every time I see him on screen, I kind of find it funny. It's like, wow, like I saw him on The Bridge, I figured, oh, that's part of the type of character this guy always plays. And so in a way, he's playing against type. Of course, maybe he's played nice guys before, but just thought I'd throw that in there.
I think the dad's name is Manuel. I think it's Manuel Varga.
Oh, I meant the actor's name.
Sorry.
That's okay. It's good to know the character's name too. I'll call him Manny now. No, just kidding.
I don't get the impression that he will survive the series. I'm not sure what's going to happen, but I just but you never know. I mean, this is not a predictable show as this kind of stuff goes. So maybe not. Maybe he'll be okay.
Maybe not.
But he's probably done for.
Yeah, I would put him on the list of likely to die. So I agree. Even though I hate when we talk about TV shows that way, but I do it like everybody else. We always talk about who's likely to die on a show. It's like, as if that's what it always comes down to. Speaking of people likely to die, but many years later on Breaking Bad, spoiler, let's finish up by talking about Mike. The episode actually begins with what I guess one could call a flashback, or just call it a memory. And we realize at a certain point it's of a younger version of Mike, and he's laying cement while he's, you know, his son Maddie is, you know, intensely interested in this fascinating task, and then gets to like even. And I think we find, if we didn't realize who these two characters were, and I wasn't sure. But the moment when the kid writes his name in the cement and you see it's Maddie, and then we switch and see Mike, then it's like, oh, okay. Now my question is, because that's the opening scene. We get that, then we have a brief flash of seeing Mike in that survivor therapy group. Cut to the opening credit, you know, opening titles. Did we think that was just at that point, because I think we find out later on, did we think that was an act, just a memory of Mike in that moment, or do we think that he had actually told that as a story in that group at that point? I mean, based on what we know, what happens towards the end of the episode, doesn't seem like it's something he would have told the group. So is this just something that's on his mind in that moment, or are we just getting a memory he has of his son? Is this the kind of thing that he thinks about from time to time?
I took it as that was his motivating factor to be pissed off at the guy that was lying. That, you know, if you genuinely are grieving and have been through something, somebody who's a poser, a faker, a douchebag like that guy, mm-hmm. just really rubbed him the wrong way. And so in his mind, even if he's not talking, he is sitting there processing things.
Right.
In the group, and that guy, like whenever that guy talked, it was so fraudulent that, you know, his memory is real and something he hangs on to, that was his motivating factor to say he'd had enough and just basically destroy the guy later.
Okay.
Yeah, when I saw it at the beginning, I thought that maybe Mike told some version of the story that he told in way back in season 1 and 5-0 mm-hmm. To the group. And that's whatever. And then later on, I just, you know, figured that his reason is it was just, you know, that's what he was thinking as his impetus for outing the, you know, Henry Winkler's lawyer on Parks and Recreation for being a douchebag. And
right. I recognize him too.
Yeah.
So later on in the episode, we see Mike meeting the woman Anita in that diner. Now, this clearly has been some sort of relationship here. You know, the waitress knows her name, what she orders, whatever. There's that feeling of familiarity between them. I'm assuming it's based on the kind of person Mike is, that they're, you know, quote unquote, just friends, but I'm not, you know, I can't be, you know, positive about that. But that's when they start talking about the douchebag you were just referring to, Brian, you know, that one guy in the survivor group that Anita thinks she wants to reach out to. And that's when Mike basically says he's a fraud. Watch for his tell, he tells her, when they make a little bet about it. That he rubs his wrist whenever he tells, you know, yet another story that doesn't quite add up about his fake dead wife. So then later we're actually in group. And we see that Mike is sitting next to Stacy, his daughter-in-law. And she tells us rather, you know, sad story about the fact that that morning when she was making breakfast, she realized it was the first time she didn't think about her dead husband. And she didn't think about Maddie. And as sad as her little, what she was saying was, dialogue-wise, Mike's face in that scene during that whole part, that alone, I thought, like, that's an Emmy-worthy face right there. Because obviously, on one hand, he could have just played it like, you know, he's a little sad. But it looks like there's like a swirl of emotions there. Because, you know, there's sadness, there's anger, there's guilt. You know, there's almost a seething quality to it, which of course we see much more so once Henry the Douche walks in. But then starts to talk. But I was really taken with that. Jonathan Banks has, again, long career, many, many TV shows and movies, whatever. But I've enjoyed him so much in what he's gotten to do in such a minimalist way, playing Mike Ehrmantraut, and more so on this series than even on Breaking Bad, although he certainly had several great moments in Breaking Bad. But that was really... And of course, we see it's a prelude to what happens just, you know, a minute later when the douche does start... I keep calling him the douche because he called him the douche now. I don't know. I can't help it now. when Mike essentially exposes him in front of the group, and that alone would have been like, oh... Because you can kind of like, you can also be rooting for Mike at that point because, you know, he just exposed this fraud, this poser, this guy who's just there to, you know, he gets in some sort of vicarious, you know, needs fulfilled by being in this group. But then he kind of nails the entire group as well. And so basically rips all of them. I think he said something along the lines of, how they're all wrapped up in their little stories, feeding off each other's misery. And getting to what the title, one of the possible reasons for the title episode, like, you wanted me to talk, so I talked. I couldn't help but think, though, how is this going to affect, well, let's see, there's a relationship with the Anita person, again, but they're probably just friends. What about Stacy? Because it feels like this might have really could have set off a little bomb in his relationship with his daughter-in-law. I mean, that was what I was thinking when that whole
thing. Right, and he did, you know, ignore one of her calls later in the episode too.
Right.
Yeah, I thought his acting. I mean, what's so interesting about that scene is. It's there's anger and grief, but the way it ends, I mean, in a perverted way, it's very much dark comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because when he gets done saying it, the guy doesn't say a word. Like, he so completely destroys him, the guy just sort of gets up. And what I thought was comical was the guy who ran the group and is like, now, Mike, let's not. And it's like Mike just keeps going and the guy shuts up. I mean. So even in that group, those people with the limited interaction they've had with Mike, I think, get a sense of menace from him, which we see grows in his character over time.
And look, one could also say, knowing the past and the future history of Mike Ehrmantraut, that if he was going to go and say something in this group, he wasn't going to do no half measure here. He went full measure. He didn't just rip the guy; yeah. He ripped the group and the whole situation.
Well, he does have a code. I mean, the thing we know about Mike is he does have a code, and even if it's a little perverted, if you violate that code, he doesn't tolerate it. And you see that in this group. And when I don't know that he turned on the group because of who they were, or he turned on them because they were able to put up with a faker. And that's the hypocrisy he saw in it, that they were so caught up in their own grief that they would let anybody join as long as they had, you know, a story to tell, regardless of its truthfulness or if it seemed genuine. You know, Mike is a creature of this code that he sticks to, and when it's violated, I mean, he's done, and you see him be done. I'll be curious to see if he ever goes back to the group after this.
That'll be fascinating if he does. So next we see he's still doing his completely unasked for consulting work at one of those Madrigal warehouses. I won't really get into. I'm not going to get into the specifics of what he does. You know, he's checking the truck and the items and blah, 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 whatever. Not really all that relevant. What's relevant is that he gets a call to, quote unquote, to come meet him tonight. Clearly we know it's going to be Fring. So now we're getting to the closing of the episode. And I love whenever characters, especially on these shows, meet, it's always kind of has to be this, you know, this beautifully eerily lit place where it's, you know, it's either it's a warehouse or a parking lot or whatever, you know, a place where, you know, there could be any number of people hiding with guns and this, even though in this situation, they're all pretty much all out in the open all around and whatever. And this is one of the first times, at least initially we think it's genuine when it may not really be totally genuine, where Fring is pissed off. Even though the way Mike speaks back to him and kind of pierces through it, it turns out it may be more bluster than actual anger at this point from Fring. Because he keeps saying to him, is there anything you want to tell me? You know, there's something you haven't told. And Mike figures out this is going back to Nacho and the whole situation with, you know, the switching the pills and whatever, and the fact that although Mike wasn't a participant in the plan, he knew what was going on, might have given a little advice. And because I think, doesn't he say something like that? You said I told you I wouldn't do anything to Don Hector. You didn't say I had to stop anyone else or something like that. I didn't write it down in front of me anywhere.
Yeah, he said he wasn't going to be his bodyguard.
Right. But the great thing about this, you know, pretty much Mike is just not intimidated. He's like, you're going to pull a gun on him, go ahead, because no one's going to, because that's not what he's there for. And the episode actually ends with him saying, why don't you stop running a game here and just tell me about the job. And that's kind of the closing. And of course, I was a little frustrated, because I was like, wait, that's how you're going to end? You're not going to give me another minute or two? Because I was really into that scene. because these are two of the most intimidating characters, you know, on the show. So what did you guys think of this? And why do you think Fring wants to talk with Mike? What do you think this possible job might be for him?
Gus seems to recognize that Mike is very savvy about what he's doing. And I think in a way, you know, when he tested him, Mike came back with, hey, you know, if you're going to do it, make your move. I think that's what he said, is, you know, make your move. Mike both is savvy, but also really can't be scared or intimidated by him.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the question is the natural progression of Mike, getting him out of the warehouse to do what? And my thought is, based on what we've seen this season, that Mike, based on all the processes he's observed, the way he's looked at the warehouse, the way he's done all this thing at Madrigal, that, you know, maybe this is where we see Gus send Mike on the task of find a spot that's secure, find a spot that is suitable, where we can start the operation. Because we had the previous scene in the season where the Don says, hey, you know, start buying on this side of the border. Gus now maybe sees an opportunity to start the process to build the lab. Maybe that's what Mike will be set on the task to based on what he's done in Madrigal.
Hmm. Interesting. Daniel.
Sorry, I just ate a peanut butter egg, which you love. So my mouth is filled with delicious peanut butter goodness. Well, I bought 10 pounds after like some holiday, and I still have just tons of them.
Oh my god.
I guess the holiday would be Easter. But.
Yeah, that's.
I was going to ask: was the holiday like National Diabetes Awareness Holiday? If you bought 10 friggin' pounds.
Yeah, well, it's taken me. It's been Easter, and I haven't even made it through 5 pounds of it yet.
Oh,
and I have kids.
It wouldn't have lasted a week here. So.
I'm all about moderation, but
yeah.
I'm wondering if what Gus wants Mike to do has to do with the, you know, something to do with the new territory. If he wants, you know, I wouldn't think he'd have him oversee that kind of thing, but it is kind of, you know, a new development in what's going on with the freeing stuff. I mean, you know, so I think it might have something to do with that. I definitely thought that, I mean, they're all, you know, keep saying, you know, it's a new ability of this, this sentence. But I did think.
That's interesting. Go on.
Yeah. I did think that, that Gus, even though he's not thrilled with Nacho after what he did, he certainly seemed to have a little bit more respect for Nacho earlier in the episode when Nacho clearly saw what Gus was doing.
Right.
I mean, there definitely seemed to be that kind of thing going on there. So I'm wondering if maybe, you know, he might have, you know, Gus might have Nacho and Mike work together since he knows they have a relationship
mm-hmm.
with something to do with that, potentially.
Possibly.
And, I mean, those two actors, I mean, they play off each other really nicely. So it'd be, especially now, it'd be interesting to see Mike with a more world-weary seasoned Nacho instead of, like, what we've seen before.
By the way, I'm just trying to, because I don't know if this was ever clearly said during the course of Breaking Bad. I'm seeing we just all assumed it. Because in Breaking Bad, we see Gus Fring, and we see the people working for him. We see Victor, and we see the guy whose name I forget every time we do this podcast, cause if I don't have it in front of me.
Tyrus, thank you.
And Mike, whatever. And it was like, my impression when we watched Breaking Bad was the hierarchy was Mike was above those two. Now, that might be just the racist in me. I don't know. But, no, just kidding. Is that how you guys saw it when you watched Breaking Bad, or not?
I got the sense that the only person when we watched Breaking Bad, the only person Gus answered to was it Stephen Bauer that played the drug lord that
yes.
killed his
yes
you know the
yeah
I got the yeah, sense in watching Breaking Bad Stephen Bauer's character was the only person he answered to and that he was sort of sovereign beyond that.
Oh no, yeah. I know, yes, I know that, but you know, I'm saying as far as who his main guy was, his right hand man, his number one, if you will, you know, the Riker to his Picard, you know.
I misunderstood your question, but I always took it that it was Mike in Breaking Bad, and I think you know, in a lot of what Dan said, it is interesting, and there it is, damn it, you all put it in my head, and I've said it like five times now, so that's the serious TV drama podcast drinking game, drink when it's stored interesting said So, you know, the cousins, I believe, were sent back to Mexico to chill out after the gunfight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes.
So, you know, Mike can do security while they're gone. So that's a possibility. He also could be a mentor to Nacho. And, you know, because Mike is also coolly rational, I think he's a more suitable choice to be the number two, because he's not going to shoot people out and do the crazy stuff some of the other people would do. Right. So I always took Mike was his right hand man in Breaking Bad. So this is maybe that rise.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. Okay, I just want to make sure it wasn't just my. I mean, although I watched up until, except for the last season, all the other seasons of Breaking Bad several times, I actually haven't watched it in years now. So it's, which means I really need to do a rewatch pretty soon, because just had the 10-year anniversary. I feel bad that it's starting to slip out of my memory, because, you know, I'm getting old and mushy here. So maybe I'll do that soon.
Yeah. Yeah, I still think that, you know, Mike's rise might occur in a little bit more fits and starts instead of like a straight upward trajectory from here. Because even if Gus was just blustering stuff, I still don't think he's happy with Mike about this Nacho thing, and he doesn't completely trust him after that. So mm-hmm. I think it might take, more than one or, you know, one or two successful missions before Mike's quite ready to move up.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Plus, I also think you have to have... If this is a series that's going to continue for more than just one more season, and I think we all believe it will continue for more than one more season, the way everyone seems to be talking about it, you got to have some sense of conflict within that organization. So you're right. I don't think it can just be a straight shot to the top kind of thing. Also, bearing in mind, this is 2003, I think we fit determined already. And when we pick up with them again in Breaking Bad, it's at least it's 5 years later, or 5.5 years later, or something like that. Because Breaking Bad starts in 2008, so hence the 10-year anniversary, blah, blah, blah. Okay, Brian, I know you I'll try you first, because I know you like to take down little notations or whatever. Was there anything else about this or anything else in the episode that we hadn't covered that maybe you wanted to highlight before we move on here?
The only thing that stood out to me other than what we've covered is I really like the way they used the music in the montage of Jimmy painting the window.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of like went in fits and starts, and it was really unique. Like I don't know that I had heard them use music in quite that way. I thought that because it I remember watching the scene when he was painting the window and thought, this show is so freaking good that I'm transfixed watching a guy paint a window and wondering what the hell's on it, even though I know it's just a window at a cell phone store.
Well, the show is all about watching people perform tasks and trying to figure out what it's actually going to lead to. Because half the time when there's a task being done, we don't actually know, we don't necessarily know exactly what it is that's being done until either it's finished or at a certain point in it. So there's a very mild surprise element every time they kind of do that on the show, I think. Daniel, is there anything you want to highlight or lowlight here?
No, we've covered everything I think I had on my list, which is basically just the Star Trek connection. I really didn't care about anything else. Well, then, you know, plus Jamie did basically spoil the entire episode, so I can't really say I was paying close enough attention anyway, since it was ruined for me, and the sequel show Breaking Bad was also ruined for me, because now I know the secret of that and those fucking cell phones. Damn it.
God,
that's the trouble. You go on social media too quick, and you're going to get stung sometime, even with a show like this.
Oh my God!
You know, Dan, I think you should complain that Google and stuff is messing up search results to run things for people like you.
Hey, I might do that. Hold on, give me a second. Nope, I don't have a really small dick, so I guess I don't have to do that.
Wow, that wasn't the answer I was looking for, but well played.
You wanted me to tell you? Actually, no.
Oh, stop. Make it stop. I really didn't want that to be the last thing before I go to wrapping it.
I went to 2001 A Space Odyssey in the IMAX on Saturday with my son, and it was awesome. And when the monolith on the moon freaks out and makes a loud noise, I swear, like, it was so loud, everybody in the theater, like, had to grab their heads, and it was awesome, because, like, everybody was grabbing their heads on the, like, huge screen in front of us. That was a good experience.
What did your son think of it?
He's 12. I thought he might be, like, bored-ish, because I remember, like, it wasn't really so much bored growing up watching it, but I definitely remember, like, you know, the pacing. I mean, it probably took, you know, when I was little, in my mind, it probably took, you know, an hour of the movie was just getting to the moon or getting to the space station. But he enjoyed it. He seemed, he was able to pick up on, like, you know, what was going on, you know, from the, like, even like the weird ending, even though, I mean, it's other than, like, the character theoretically evolving into some kind of, you know, I'm trying not to spoil 2001. That's incredible of me on the 50th anniversary.
You can spoil the ending of 2001. I'm sorry. It's 50 years. It's okay.
But other than the loud, how loud it got at times, which was, you know, I guess just an IMAX thing and wasn't really a big detraction. He actually, you know, he liked it. He didn't think it was too slow or anything. So I guess it says something for the kind of stuff that I've had them grow up watching. If he didn't find 2001 to be a sad 3-hour like distraction from Fortnite or whatever the hell he'd rather be doing.
Right. I remember seeing that. God, maybe. You know what? It might have been. It could have been 25 years ago. So it could have been like the 25th anniversary of it. It was at Lincoln. I went to Lincoln Center to see that, and then they had a panel up on stage talking after it. I don't remember who. Maybe like three people there, and I honestly don't remember who two of them were. So they must have been people involved more on the technical side, perhaps. And Keir Dulé was there, so that was cool. So I got to see you know David Bowen right there. So that was neat. And it was funny because as he's aged, he actually has started to look like the different versions of David Bowman at the end of 2001 to the point where it's like, wow, those makeup guys were way better than I realized they were. He really does look like that. All right. Okay, that's a much better note to end on. Okay, so if y'all out there, I'm talking like Brian, if you enjoyed this podcast, chances are you'll enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. You can like the page and join the conversation about shows like Better Call Saul and so many others. I'm telling you, something has happened on Facebook and I can't figure it out. And maybe it's because they keep switching and changing their algorithms or this, that, and the other thing. And I don't want to get into a tangential conversation about all the other stuff that's been going on with Facebook over the last several months. But it's weird because I don't know if other people can see this. Maybe, I don't know if it's an admin thing or not. I have no idea. But when something is posted on Facebook and on that page specifically, I can always see the number of views. Actually, I think other people can too because I see that on other pages. So that's absolutely it. And all of a sudden, in the last couple weeks, it seems like everything that's been posted there, like the numbers are ridiculously low. And I know they're wrong because there's a couple instances where there's more people who liked and or commented on it than you're saying viewed the thread, which doesn't make any sense. So I don't know what's going on there. It's very
strange. People are commenting on it that haven't seen it according to the thing. So yeah. Facebook's grief lately. It's been giving me all sorts of grief, which we're not going to talk about.
Very strange. Anyway, but beyond Facebook, you can also catch us on iTunes, Serious TV Drama Podcast. You can subscribe to our feed as well as rate and review us there. And as I've said, as I keep saying in every podcast, you can also just pop in Serious TV Drama Podcast and you can find us on Google. Actually, you can even pop in STVD Podcast and you can find us on Google and a number of places. Even YouTube sometimes, even though we're banned in certain countries because of Dan's excessive use of the word interesting. No, just kidding. And finally, you can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is STVD Podcast. It's STVD as in series TV drama podcast. And yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah. Good show, guys. Thanks for joining us again, Hepatitis B, Ryan.
Well, thank you, Daniel. I appreciate such a fine compliment.
God.
You're welcome.
Oh, boy. Anyway, yes, thank you, Brian, for joining us. Look at that. Three people, one episode. Nicely timed. Tight. You're supposed to be saying that, Dan, not me. All right. Let me stop before.
I wish.
Let me stop before. Next thing you know, this is gonna. We add another 25 minutes, and then it's like the first couple of the season. So again, always great talking with you, Dan, as well. And I'll say goodnight to you and Brian, and I'll let you guys take it away with the final goodnights.
Good night. See you guys. Thanks for having me.
You can say goodnight again, Dan. Go ahead.
Good night again, Brian, and the other guys, and the listeners. Don't.